Very good. Nice to be here, to be with you all. Sorry, Catherine couldn't join me. She's off with Liz, plotting their ways that they might improve the behaviour of their husbands. Well, I gather that's what those things are about. So what I also would like to know is how Mary managed to get into my study and Mark got into my study and somehow read my exhortation. Because to be honest, I could not have picked a better hymn for my exhortation. I'll come back to that at the end. So what I wanted to share with you this morning is some thoughts which came out of a study that I did on Hezekiah. Hezekiah has been a favourite study of mine, and recently I came back to it when I did the series of Hezekiah in Australia. And I wanted to focus particularly on the development of Hezekiah's trust, because the record in 2 Kings 18 says of Hezekiah that he was unique of all the kings of Israel, before or after him, in regard to trust. It makes quite an emphatic statement. It says of Hezekiah in verse 5 of 2 Kings 18 that he trusted in the Lord God of Israel, so that there was none like him among all the kings of Judah after him, nor among those who were before him. So when you look at the life of Hezekiah, the one word that comes out of the story of Hezekiah is trust. And the first question I asked was why was Hezekiah unique in his trust? We think about the great kings, this included David. David was a great man who trusted. Josiah, a great man who trusted in God. But Hezekiah, it says, trusted more than any king before him or after him. In fact, I think Hezekiah's trust probably stands out as the greatest of all until one man said, "Into thy hands I commit my spirit." And those last words of Jesus were the absolute surrender of trust, or a statement of trust from our Lord. And the reason I think Hezekiah had this trust is because he was put to the test more than any other king. He faced the greatest army that had ever walked the planet. When Sennacherib came down with Assyria, they marched up against Jerusalem. It was terrifying. And everybody was running around in panic as to what was going to happen. But Hezekiah remained resolute. So in this study, I looked at what are the building blocks of trust, or what's the difference, first of all, between perhaps trust and faith? I don't think there is a lot of difference, by the way. I think they are kind of interchangeable. Very much the same idea. Faith is belief. And so is trust, a conviction of a belief in something. But I think trust is more about faith in practice. And to give you an illustration, I remember when my kids were quite young, taking them to the pool, the swimming pool, and they couldn't swim. Or at least Justin couldn't swim. Pete was a little bit older. And I know you've all done this before at the pool, where you're sitting down there and Dad's in the water and the kids are up on the side and you're saying, "Jump, I'll catch you." Now, the child weighs up in his mind different reasons about why he might develop faith in jumping. And so he has this faith and his belief that, yes, my dad will catch me. He's not going to let me drown. And I know this because when I look at him, he's strong. My dad's Superman. He would never let me fall. And so I trust that I can jump. That's faith. Trust is when he jumps. Now, a little later on in the swimming pool, Peter's down there in the water, my eldest son, holding out his arms to Justin and saying, "Jump, Justin, I'll catch you." Well, there's no way at all that Justin was going to jump. What's the difference in terms of what's going on? And in my research in Hezekiah, I found, and in research in terms of the building blocks of trust and trying to unravel what trust is, I found that there's three things. And since doing this study, I've applied this to looking at many examples in Scripture. It fits Hezekiah perfectly, but it's also going to fit the story that we're going to come to in Luke chapter 24. And I'm going to give you an acronym so you can remember it. ELLA. Just remember ELLA. E-L-A. The first building block of trust is empathy. E for empathy. And this is an emotional connection. So E also stands for emotion, empathy. It's a connection that you have with your heart. Empathy is when you show or you let down your guard, you show vulnerability, and you connect with somebody else. And you become interested in their story. Empathy is about listening to other people's story. And when you think about different professions in the world, the ones that are trusted the most is normally the ones in the medical field. So you find counselors, psychiatrists, doctors, paramedics. Medical people are generally seen as the most trusted profession. Why? Because when you go and see them, you have to go through a vulnerable process because you're exposing a weakness, an illness, and you're wanting to share with them. And they are taught and trained to listen and to care. And so that's why they're very trusted. Some of the most least trusted professions are things like lawyers, because you never really feel that empathetic connection with them. Used car salesmen are often in that same category. You don't really feel like they're wanting to know all about your story. They're more wanting to tell their story of this car. So salespeople in general can often be, you know, not trusted. Politicians, definitely not necessarily trusted. So that's the first one, empathy. The next one, L, is logic. We trust something because it makes sense, because it has a logical structure to it. And that's an intellectual thing. You know, as part of our faith is that our belief structure makes sense. It's logical. When I had my hip operation, I went to hospital, and the nurse that was treating me was this lovely Indian nurse, and I got talking to her a bit, and she was a Christian. Anyway, when I went and came back from anaesthetic, she came and talked with me, and she was very sad. And I could tell straight away that something was not right. And I said to her, you know, are you okay? And she says, no, I'm not at all. She said, while you were under anaesthetic, we lost a work colleague. And her work colleague was killed in a motorbike accident. And then she went on to talk about her distress that was going on in her mind, reconciling. The problem she had was this colleague was a lovely man, but this lovely man refused to have anything to do with God. He was completely an atheist in that regard, and she had talked to him numerous times, and he basically said, I don't want a bar of religion, I don't believe in God. Yet he was the nicest man you can imagine. Now the problem is, within Christianity and common belief, of course, is the unbeliever would not receive a reward. A person who refuses, how can God give a reward to somebody that does not believe? It's the first essence of faith. He that comes to God must believe that he is, and that he's the rewarder of them that diligently seek him. So if this man that she knew was a lovely man has not gone to heaven, then where has he gone? The only answer in her mind is that he's gone to hell. This man that spent his life caring for other people. And her reconciling of this, of a righteous God which could watch a person in torment forever, burning forever and ever and ever and ever, doesn't have any logic about it. It makes no sense. So that's one of the beauties about our belief structure, is it's logical. It declares God righteous. We can understand and we can answer that. And so I was able to talk to her briefly about these things. So that's the second thing, logic. The third thing is more practical. And the A stands for authenticity. We trust something because of its authenticity. And that's normally established over a long period of time. We trust something because it's genuine. When you see, you know, reliable brands, you trust those brands because they are the genuine article. And normally that reputation is built up over time. And this is practical. So the first one is emotional, the second one is logical, and the third one is practical. It's practical because it's been put to the litmus test and it's been proven to be of good quality. And so when you look around, that's what we do, don't we? We trust brands because of certain quality that's associated with those brands. And you'll find that companies like Apple are very good at marketing their products based on those three things. They appeal to people's emotion. You'll look good if you have this new iPhone because it's so sleek. You can have it in multiple colours. Then they appeal to the logic. Oh, and it does all of these features. It's really good. And then they appeal to the brand. And by the way, Apple is the strongest brand on the market. It's been around forever. It's so reliable, it's never going to break down. It's not a lemon. So that's how they market. They market based on those things. And that's how we understand these things. So when I was in India, for instance, I'm not a big thing with brands on clothes, but when it comes to shoes, I think because, you know, shoes are comfortable, that's what I look for. Something which is comfortable that I can wear and practical, so I do go looking for brands. And the problem is in India you can buy a lot of things cheap, really cheap, so it's good. But looking for authenticity in India can be a bit of a challenge, because there's something about authenticity in India is you can see a brand, but you have to be very careful not to believe the label. So it can't be just in the name, it's actually got to be in the quality of the product as well, which I discovered the first time I bought a lovely pair of Ray-Bans for about a dollar and tried to put it over my bigger head and the arm snapped off. And I realised that probably wasn't a genuine pair of Ray-Bans. And then there was the time I went to buy some shoes and I went into a lovely big shoe shop and I said to the man, I said, do you happen to have any Hush Puppies? And he said, yes sir, we have Hush Puppies. And I said, oh, good. So he went and grabbed the box and he got out the box and he found my shoe size and he said, sir, these are genuine Hush Puppies. They just don't have the label. So at that point, I was kind of suspicious that this might not be the genuine article because it didn't have the label. And that's kind of how, you know, we establish trust. We establish trust based on empathy, logic, and authenticity. I want to show you this in the story of the two on the road to Emmaus as we prepare for bread and wine this morning. In this story on the two on the road to Emmaus, it's an unusual account in Luke's Gospel. It's unusual because it only appears in Luke's Gospel, it's not in any of the other records. It's also unusual because the two people mentioned on the road to Emmaus are mystery people. There's a lot of people that think, obviously we know the name of one of them, Cleopas, and there has been some endeavor to make connection to the mention of another person in the New Testament called Clopas. I can assure you they're actually two very different names because they're from different languages. This name is of Roman background, from where you get Cleopatra, and the word Clopas is actually of Hebrew origin. So they're totally different names. It's just that they sound similar in English. So this is the only time this person appears in the Bible record. He's a mystery person, and whoever he's traveling with is a mystery person as well. But it gets more mysterious than that, because when you research and try to find this place, Emmaus, and you can do a lot of research on it, there's a lot of comments about where it might be. Now, it should be easy to find, because all we know is it's 7 miles from Jerusalem. So you should be able to draw a compass 7 miles from Jerusalem, draw a circle, and find this place. But what you find is that there's a lot of commentary by some of the Bible dictionaries, by Josephus and other historians. And the only thing that is common amongst all of those is that they all disagree on where it is. And no one actually knows where it is. So here's the second interesting thing about this story. You've got two mystery people going to a mystery place. Doesn't that sound strange? And in fact, the only thing we know about Emmaus is what its name means. So in the root of the word Emmaus has this idea of tepid or lukewarm. It's believed to be a place of lukewarm springs. Now we know what kind of the idea of lukewarm is, don't we? Because the Bible uses that idea about being lukewarm. So here you've got a picture of these two mystery disciples, and they're going away from Jerusalem. And that's the other point about Emmaus. Its geography is specific in relationship to Jerusalem. And herein is the true answer to our story. Because when you go through Luke's Gospel, you'll find that everything revolves around Jerusalem. Jerusalem's mentioned more times in Luke's Gospel than all the other Gospels. In fact, everything starts in Jerusalem. Remember, they take Jesus up into the city, into Jerusalem, and there's a woman there called Anna, and what it says of her is she continued in the temple and departed not from the temple day and night, waiting for, and the words are, redemption in Jerusalem. That's the words of Luke chapter 2. So the gospel starts with Jesus appearing to a woman who departs not from the temple day and night. Now, you'll see how this chapter finishes at the end, or the book finishes. So they returned to Jerusalem with great joy and were continually in the temple praising God. In fact, Jesus told them to depart not from the city. So there's this connection with Jerusalem being the center place of where redemption would come in Luke's Gospel. Now this story is about two people on a journey away from Jerusalem going down to a place called Emmaus, which means lukewarm. And they are confused, and they are sad, and they are distressed. And what does Jesus do? Well, it says, as they were walking with each other in verse 14 and talking and discussing, Jesus drew near and went with them and said to them, "What's this conversation you are holding? And why are you so sad?" Now, the first thing is that's really odd about this is, imagine sitting there having a conversation that you're having with somebody privately about different things, and the stranger suddenly walks up and says, "Hey, what are you talking about?" This would be like, "Excuse me? Who are you? But you'll notice that Jesus beautifully joins in and walks with them for some time first. He walked with them till they were comfortable with him being there. And then he asks them, what are they talking about? And why are you so sad? Now that is the key lesson of empathy. You want to learn what empathy is? It's about knowing, it's about listening to somebody else's story. It's about seeing their pain. And they open up and they begin to talk. And they share with Jesus everything. And they tell him all about certain things. And they say, are you a stranger? Haven't you heard about the things that have happened? And he says, what things? Tell me. And you see how he's just drawing them out. And so they tell him. And that's the first stage of empathy. After a while, it says in verse 25, he said to them, O foolish ones and slow of heart. By the way, I think that's quite a gentle rebuke. O foolish ones and slow of heart to believe all the prophets have spoken. Wasn't it necessary that Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory? And beginning at Moses and all the prophets, he expounded to them and interpreted all the scriptures concerning them. Now here's the logic. He's going to start from here and he's going to go bang, 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 bang. And all of a sudden that empathetic connection, they've connected with him personally, is now going to have logic in everything that he says. But at this stage, the fire is starting to burn, isn't it? Because it says later on, did not our hearts burn within us? They've been heading down to Emmaus, going from hot to cold, down to lukewarm. And as they're going, Jesus is about to reignite that fire. And they're going to start burning with excitement. Did not our hearts burn within us? But at this stage, they're still going on. So then it says, they drew near to a village which they were going to, and he acted as if he would go further. But they urged him strongly, stay with us, for it's toward the evening. You know, that's one of the greatest things in life, isn't it? Never let Jesus walk past your house. They urged him to come inside. They didn't let him walk past. And in life, that's a vital thing in our life and our relationship with the Lord, is to urge him to come inside our personal lives, into our homes. And so they urged him and constrained him, and he went in and they sat at the table together. And when he took the bread, he blessed and broke it and gave it to them, and then their eyes were opened. At that point, at that very concise point, their eyes were opened. Why? Why now? Because he took the bread and he broke it and he gave it to them. And right in his hands were the brands of authenticity. The practical mark of who he was, the sacrifice which was seen in his hand. Didn't he say to Thomas, Thomas, thrust your hand into my side, put your fingers into my hands, be not unbelieving, but be believing. In fact, he does this again in the same chapter. Verse 38, when he met the disciples back again, he says, why are you troubled, and why do doubts arise in your hearts? See my hands. And you see the evidence that Jesus used all the time to authenticate who he was were the marks in his hands and his feet. He's the genuine article because of the brands that he bears. Jesus said to Thomas, blessed are you, Thomas, because you have seen these things. But blessed are those who have not seen these things and yet believe. So we haven't seen the brand in his hand and his feet. But what we do have before us is a symbol that we remember week by week. A simple means to remember that sacrifice. A symbol of bread and of wine. They are the brand mark that we have to remember his sacrifice. And the thing is, life is, after these disciples came back, they were just full of energy and enthusiasm. They went down to Emmaus dragging their feet. They came back to Jerusalem, and it says their hearts burned within them. And it says, as we said in this record, they returned to Jerusalem with great joy. What a contrast. They go down sad and they come back with great joy and continue in the temple day and night praising God. You know, sometimes in life we're going to find ourselves walking in the wrong direction. We're going to find ourselves a little bit disorientated with life and the path that life is taking us. We're going to find ourselves dragging our feet. We're going to find ourselves suffering. He will come. He promised he'll come. I will never leave you nor forsake you. I am with you to the end of the age. He's alive. He's real. And when we do wander, he'll come. We just have to identify when he does. We just have to see what are the building blocks of trust. We have to feel the empathy, have to understand the logic, and have to see the authenticity that he is the only one that can return us to Jerusalem with great joy. And he will. He'll bring us back. And so now I want to show you why Mark read my study notes. Just to finish, I want to read this hymn again. Lord, who has set our mortal feet on life's uncertain way, to thee in fellowship of need we lift our hearts today. Whenever we walk in your clear light, we journey unafraid. Yet often do we miss the gleam and wander in the shade. If some who tread life's path with us are burdened and oppressed, help us to share with them the gifts of courage and of rest. And you who know the path we take, who sees how oft we roam, reveal yourself the living way and guide all travellers home.